Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Ms. Andrea Kane Collier. She has over 30 years of experience reporting on medicine, public health, healthcare, and healthcare policy for national publications and news outlets, which include NBC, Next Avenue, and Essence. Her work on health, education, and family has also appeared in O Magazine and AARP Magazine, among others. She is the author of Still With Me, A Daughter's Journey of Love and Loss for Simon & Schuster, and The Black Woman's Guide to Black Men's Health for Warmer Wellness. And with that, I'd like to welcome Ms. Collier. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have a very fascinating story that really begins for many years, to be quite honest, and looking at your history as a journalist, but it became particularly interesting during the pandemic. As someone who wrote extensively about the pandemic and then essentially experienced the worst of COVID-19, you have a very unique story. Tell us your story as you experienced it from the beginning of the pandemic to when you first contracted COVID-19 to where you are now.
Okay. I keep a very busy travel schedule, and my travel for the year of 2020 was booked so tight, traveling for work and interviews and some other things that I do. And on March 20th, I think it was, I was scheduled to go out on a trip. And that was like the real first serious rumblings that COVID was going to be a thing, and that's when they started canceling events. For me, as a journalist and a storyteller, I figured out that if you put "in the age of COVID" on the front of any pitch to any venue, they were gonna say yes. But that's what happened. And I wrote a lot about COVID. Well, really, I wrote about COVID, but I also wrote about the impacts on people, which is always my first line of defense. While some people were writing about the trajectory of the virus, I was writing about what happens with people, what happens in schools. My husband is an elementary school teacher at that time. He's a middle school teacher now. But what does it mean for people having to teach in the classrooms? At that point, they had not gone to virtual schooling. Eventually that year they did. But both of us, my husband and I, were probably at really high risk because you're African American. We were 64 at that time. No, we were 63 at that time. We were 63 at that time. We were African American. We didn't have any pre-existing conditions, but as you know, your pre-existing conditions don't necessarily show up until they show up.
Yep.
I was really fearful and didn't have a real problem with shutting down, wearing masks. And I listened to the science almost incessantly. The TV was always on. I was always looking at studies. I did not like not knowing. Well, that was the hardest part at first. Not knowing what to expect. You know, there were some other things going on in America in 2020 that only heightened my anxiety. You had a really fractious election going on, and you had the whole George Floyd, Black Lives Matter thing. Mm. And all that really sort of brought me high anxiety, and I did what I knew how to do, which was write.
Wow. So in that vein, let's perhaps go back in time to April of 2020. So you had mentioned March of 2020 is when you started seeing glimmers of the pandemic becoming a reality in people's lives. in April of 2020, early in the pandemic, you could say, you wrote an article for Zora, "Detroit is at its breaking point." You wrote of the bravery and dedication to service among healthcare workers. How did you internalize that feeling, that ethos of the healthcare workers in your writing at that point in time?
Well, I live in Lansing, Michigan, and Detroit is just down the road. It takes me about an hour to get to Detroit. And I had friends and colleagues who were working in the thick of that. And I was thinking, this is just the beginning. And they have people coming in so sick. And many of my friends in Detroit literally lost loved ones. Mm. Even at that stage, that I just figured I needed to lend voice to what they were going through. I mean, one of the things that shook me up, especially during the Delta phase of the pandemic, is the whole notion that people were dying. You know, so when people said, oh, it's just like the flu. Yeah, the flu can kill a few people. But this is killing a lot of people. And I, you know, like I said, my whole focus is the people aspect of it.
Yeah, and I think that shows later around June of 2020 when you wrote in Healthline, "Managing Your Mental Health During the Pandemic." I think you were one of the first to note that there was a lot of false information, a lot of erroneous perceptions that would come out of that false information. And so it seems like your focus shifted away from the experiences of healthcare workers to, as you'd mentioned, what you know, the stories of everyday people living their lives. What did you see in the pandemic at that time, thinking now back in June of 2020, just a few months into what's going on?
Well, it would get worse.
Yeah.
Or yeah, it would get worse. But what you were seeing is, so that by that time they had shut everything down. And when I'm home and in town, I'm not doing a ton of traveling. I mean, I limited myself to going to the grocery store and going to Target. Always masked up. And you could see it in people's faces. There were the people who were mad because they had to change their behavior. There were the people who were terrified. And it was just so much uncertainty. And if you talk to people on the phone, like your friends and people, everybody, that was the first thing that they wanted to talk about. You know, and I was doing a whole bunch of wellness checks with people, just checking in on people. Well, how are you? How, you know, many of our friends are in the same boat that we are in, that we're over 60. So I was doing a whole bunch of wellness checks. And on social media, I'm really active on social media on Facebook. So we were having some real robust conversations about how to take care of ourselves, how to take care of each other. So I was seeing that, and I was seeing the stress, starting to see the stress. But as we move further on into it, you know, mental health has its own set of stigmas, right?
Right.
And lots of times it's hard for people to say, I am so stressed. Or they might say, I'm so stressed, but they won't say, I'm suffering anxiety, because we just don't talk about mental health in that way. But over time, I can say that I was seeing that so many people could acknowledge that this wasn't their normal, that this had triggered some new stuff emotionally for them, that they were willing to face up to and admit and say, it's okay for me to say I am not doing okay.
Yeah. It's interesting that journey people go through as they take what they experience around them and start to internalize it into their own lives, their own choices, which is something you had to face later that year in November of 2020. You know, at that time you were diagnosed with COVID-19. How did you first learn that you had COVID? What was going through your mind? How did that condition first come to you? How was it first experienced?
Well, I didn't have any symptoms. Well, we had been tested twice. The first time was the hospital had set up, one of our hospitals here had set up a drive-through. And at that time, people were really curious, so they were getting tested. And we literally packed a breakfast and got in the drive-through line, and it was a 4-hour wait to get tested.
Wow.
And the reason that we got tested is that my husband is a teacher. They hadn't shut school down yet. He was concerned. I was concerned. So we went and got tested. We didn't really have any symptoms. And the test came back negative. And I'm going to say a couple of weeks later, there were some outbreaks in his school. They didn't have a great policy. But there were some outbreaks in the school. So he went and got tested again. And he asked me to go along with him just to ride in the car since he normally takes. And neither one of us expected that it would come out positive. But it was a rapid test.
Right.
They give you and you get your results a couple hours later.
Mm-hmm.
When we got home, there was they called us with the results, and the results said he had COVID. And then they said I had COVID. I'm like, what? So we both had COVID, and the symptoms didn't really. When you hear about what other people went through, ours were not bad. I was exhausted. I mean, truly, like in a tired way that I had never been before. And whenever I felt like I was tired, I just gave into it. I didn't care whatever else I had to do because I was still working, you know. The whole Zoom thing like we're doing now, and I was still getting writing assignments. I probably was busier professionally than I had been in a long time, believe it or not. But I was so tired. My appetite was kind of whacked out. Sometimes I was a little dizzy, and we probably both were pretty feverish. Now, he had some symptoms that are probably long haul for him, which are it affected his appetite and his ability to taste and smell.
Mm-hmm.
So we really, his school was trying to make him go back. This was just before Christmas, and then there was the Christmas break. And he did go back, and he went back masked up. And shortly after that, they went to virtual schooling. But it was a really interesting time. And I was terrified that something would happen to either of us, that we would get really bad symptoms. And one of us would have to go into the hospital. Because if you remember at that particular time, if you went into the hospital, you couldn't have people with you.
Yeah.
They were calling people on their phones and their iPads for people to say goodbye. That was constantly on my mind because we had this year we will have been married for 40 years. And so it was just, that part of it was really emotional. I think he was getting sick of me because I was like, are you okay?
But it's interesting that experiencing COVID directly and writing about the experience in others produces different thoughts in the mind. And I would imagine that would reflect in the writing as well. Did you notice a difference in your writing after you got COVID? A difference in how you understood the experiences of others struggling with these experiences, the iPhone goodbyes, the inability to console or be consoled as needed? Did that ring differently after you got it?
Yes and no. I mean, because I was always on high alert for everybody else anyway. I mean, I always, it didn't take us getting it for it to be real serious emotionally for me. Like I said, at that point, we had already lost several people, not in our immediate family, but I remember one of my friends called me and said he was concerned about his mother who was in a nursing home. And he was afraid that he wouldn't be able to see her. And they hadn't closed the nursing home down to the point that you couldn't take the person out. And I told him, I said, go get your mother. Just go get her. And the next day he called me and said, she's dead.
Wow.
So my empathy and my emotion and my anxiety for other people was still there. The one thing that did change around that time period was I went from being, it had already started, but I was also really angry. My anger levels were probably on 10, which was good that I didn't get to go anywhere.
What was the source of the anger?
Well, I mean, and I wasn't the only one that was following the science, but every day, like clockwork, I was following the updates.
Yeah.
Of what was going on. And, you know, on one hand, you have a Dr. Fauci who is giving you the best of the science that he could give at that time. You know, I know nothing is etched in stone. All they can do is give you what they see at that time. And then you have the person that people are looking to for true leadership who's telling you drink some bleach.
Yep. That did happen.
Or all sorts of, or take a horse pill or whatever. And it became so politicized that set me on edge. I just, all was not right with my soul at that point.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Once it became so politicized, it was like the science didn't matter. Like, we are never getting rid of this thing because people say it's not real. No matter what they do.
Why do you think that's the case? And I don't think it's unique to the pandemic, that when a scientific topic becomes politicized, it no longer becomes a scientific topic alone. It becomes this mix of emotions, mix of personal beliefs, and inevitably people get angry. They get politicized and polarized. Why do you think people behave that way when politics enters science?
I just don't know, you know, and so people can also accuse people who are following the science and they said that we're the ones who politicized it. And no, I'm just doing the best that I can here. And I don't think in my lifetime I have ever seen anything. When you talk about being politicized, I don't think that I've ever seen anything, including the next best thing I could think about is sort of the scuffle over the Affordable Care Act that became politicized versus what was good, the common good of people's health, giving access as much as possible, affordable access to people.
Yeah.
I mean, and that one was, not only was it politicized, it was racialized. It was, but this just became so hateful.
Yeah. In May of 2021, now kind of flash forwarding into the second year of the pandemic, Scientific American, in kind of an unusual change, wrote about you instead of you being the writer. They detailed your journey with COVID-19, the symptoms you were burdened with, and the perceptions that you had both when you got it and afterwards. Can you talk a little bit about the long-term effects on your body and your mind? You mentioned the anger, you mentioned the polarization, but in terms of symptom and perception of those symptoms to you as an individual, what was going through your mind weeks and months after you got COVID and the initial effects wore off?
I had done a story on some long haulers. And even if you ask me that now, my answer would be slightly different. But the long haulers, some of their symptoms would go away, but eventually go away. But some of them, they're still studying them to see what's going on with them. And I think the real story coming up is going to be the long haulers. So I was paying attention to, I was still real tired. By that time, let me see, 21. I'm trying to think if that's when we had already had our vaccines. As soon as we could get a vaccine, we did. We were, I mean, as soon as they said, okay, you can get one, I was trying to maneuver to get one.
Yeah.
And so we had maybe had by March, we had been fully vaccinated. We had, of course, we hadn't been boosted yet. But some people who had had that thought all was clear. At that point, we didn't really know that you could be infected again, right?
Yeah.
So we're still being careful. We were still, but still, the rhetoric heated up about not getting vaccinated, which that was a whole nother thing, because we also had people that we were close to who said that they were not, but they felt like they should still be able to come around us. I'm like, sorry, dude.
Yeah. So
it was hard. Now that it's interesting, that article you're talking about was written by somebody I know, and in casual conversation, she was asking me about, what are you doing here? Are you going there? Are you traveling? I mean, you could travel, but we weren't doing any of that. And so somebody called me and said, somebody called you a cave dweller. Article. And I said, what? A cave dweller. And I thought about it, and I'm like, yeah, that's me. Because as soon as people got their vaccinations, they felt like they could get on a plane and go to wherever, and we weren't doing any of that. So I was still doing, my routine has not changed all that much since the beginning of the pandemic. Even now, if you ask me how much has it changed, yesterday was the first day I had lunch with three people in somebody's house that I knew were vaccinated.
You know, these labels, cave dweller, vaccine hesitant, you know, at their core, they're words in a story that people read and then internalize the pandemic through. And I think that's the power of health journalism and health storytellers. They give a frame for which people to think about what's going on in their own lives and COVID at large. What do you think is the positive and negative effects of using these terms, using these labels to identify certain behaviors?
Well, to say somebody is vaccine hesitant is different than saying that somebody just has decided that I'm not going to go get a vaccine.
Yeah, very true.
You know, and so for, there are people who should not be vaccinated because they have some kind of condition that puts them at risk. And I got that. I was never, that was never my thing. And vaccine hesitancy, I was vaccine hesitant. Maybe I politicized COVID too, because when they were talking about in the former administration, when they were talking about you could drink bleach, I was like, this is not credible stuff. Right. And vaccine it. I'm trying now to think of the term that they used, but the notion of pushing forward a vaccine so fast, and I wasn't trusting, some people weren't trusting the science and I wasn't trusting the administration. So if people ask me back then, are you gonna get the vaccine? I'm like, nope, not getting it. Nope, I don't. And I was vaccine hesitant.
Yeah. So how did you identify then, and how do you identify now with COVID? Is it a mix of political identity, racial identity, gender identity? Do all of these kind of create a confluence of thoughts that lead to your overall belief on COVID? Or do you try to parse those things out? Do you try to parse throughout vaccine hesitancy in the African-American community, the credibility of one administration relative to the other, and then try to discern what are your true thoughts about COVID-19 absent those other beliefs? Or is that just impossible to do?
I think it's probably for someone, not for everybody, but for someone like me, it's impossible to do. I did talk to another journalist who said that part of my belief system versus somebody who didn't believe it was real is that I watch a lot of news. I talk to a lot of people. And a lot of the people who didn't take it seriously, they were looking at one news source who said that it wasn't real.
Yeah.
And the one of the things that did shock me is we know that in the African American community, there was some real hesitancy. And among young African Americans, they still don't believe it's real.
Yeah. That's a shame.
And I have two young African Americans. So that made for really interesting conversations.
So let's do that. Let's go into a conversation within your own family about COVID, about the vaccines, hesitancy, what to believe, what not to believe. And the reason why I want to go there is because you tell a story in The Moth, which is a literary outlet, internalizing the news of your son's girlfriend being pregnant. You both internalize, rationalize the story. You talk about your past, you talk about your present, and it kind of guides how you will approach the conversation and the relationship with your son going forward. Was that a similar approach to how you had these pandemic related conversations?
Yeah, except because I do what I do, and I have been writing about health and healthcare since they were little, I would have thought that I'd have been a trusted resource for them. You know, I just assumed that. And that wasn't necessarily true. We had one conversation, my son and I, and I wanted him to get, I really wanted him to get vaccinated. He lives alone, you know. And he had pretty much decided that he wasn't going to do it. Even though somebody where he worked at that time died on the job.
Wow. It's amazing how assumed credibility, if you will, or subject matter expertise that we generally would perceive someone to have based on either their training or their lived experiences vanished in the pandemic. Was that because of the uncertainty, or was there something else that kind of eroded these otherwise established social norms as to who is an expert, who is not, who is credible, and who is not?
Well, I'm not 100% sure about this, so I'll tell you some things that I knew happened. Somewhere early on in the pandemic, and then reinforced when there was a vaccine was available, if you could believe this, a rapper named Waka Flocka.
Yes, I've heard a few of his songs.
Right. I'm even surprised I remember his name. But he gave an interview where he said it was a conspiracy and it would make young Black men infertile. And that stuck somewhere in the subconscious. I mean, it was weird though. Sometimes I would hear my friends who were old men would say, you know, it'll make you infertile. I'm like, you're 100. Nobody cares. But on that same vein, like, I was not a strong enough authority on the vaccine. They just decided that they were not going to talk to me about the vaccine.
Yeah.
They just decided. But like, for some reason, my son, who is 30, is in his 30s, called me up and asked me about, his hand was hurting. He says, do you think I have arthritis? And I'm like, wait a minute. You will call me up and ask me about arthritis, but you won't talk to me about stuff that's killing people. Wow. I do look.
That's so curious. And I think a lot of people face that. And you talk to pediatricians about their experiences educating people about the COVID vaccine for pediatric populations versus patients asking pediatricians about a stomach infection in their kids. There's a certain gap, and it almost seems subconscious. There's a subconscious gap in credibility in which the healthcare world is no longer seen as a subject matter expert when it comes to the pandemic. And I'm really curious to see how that formed and if it would ever reappear for another condition.
Well, I've asked the question about to public health experts, what is this teaching you going forward? Because you know there are going to be other things.
Yeah.
You know, this is not the... We've been lucky that this is the second big one in the United States in 100 years.
That is very true.
You know, third, if you parse out HIV and AIDS, which was, from my mind, it was a pandemic too, yeah. Global pandemic too. But people tend to, you know, when the next new thing comes up, they stop talking about the last one.
It's funny how the mind works, right?
Right. And so, I don't know. They don't have a good, like, I have talked to some people who are high up on the food chain in public health, And this whole thing has boggled their mind as well. Even some of them have politicized it now.
Yeah.
Which is frightening for me.
Yeah, it seems that a lot of the behavior now is a pent-up frustration of years and years of struggling to communicate what they know to be true and what they've trained to study. It's interesting how data lost its meaning, or at least became something else when it came to pandemic data compared to data around medications for diabetic drugs or data around the definition of hypertension. I think data is going to be vastly different, and the perception of it is going to be less technical and more artistic, more perception driven. Do you see that as a writer, the value of data changing in the minds of people, or science becoming less about the technical and more about the conceptual as it relates to people's lives?
Well, I also worked on and reported on the new perceptions of data, especially when it comes to people of color.
Right.
During the pandemic. And a piece of that is folks have not kept good data on the health and well-being of people of color. Like, we sort of knew anecdotally that Black and brown people were being hit harder than their white counterparts, but we couldn't quite explain why. Because the other thing was, nobody was keeping data on Black and brown people when they got sick.
Yeah.
When so you've seen out of that some movement to get better data among vulnerable populations.
When you have these conversations about data inequity or perceived differences that lead to different clinical outcomes that can be seen in the data, how aware are you about the historical, for lack of a better word, atrocities that happened to African Americans? You know, we talk about the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. We talk about the way women were used early to study OBGYN conditions.
Yes.
How much of it is apparent in the conversations today, the historical legacies of the past?
Okay, that's a frustrating thing for me too.
Yeah.
You know, I've studied it. I look at it. I'm always reading stuff about it. But if you ask a person, say, let's just say a vaccine hesitant person who is African American, they will say, well, I don't trust it. Look at Tuskegee. Well, guess what? If you ask them one or two more questions, they can't even tell you what happened in Tuskegee.
Yeah.
It has sort of become a flag for people. I mean, and I'm going to say, and history says that there is reason for people to be distrustful and to ask questions. That is true. That is 100% true. Because some of that stuff is happening today. I don't know if you saw the story of a doctor in Indianapolis, well, no, in Bloomington, which is actually where I went to school, who got COVID, was in the hospital, and saw from the inside out the differences in the way that people are treated. Even, like, she kept telling people, I'm a doctor, I'm a doctor, I'm a doctor. And 3 days later, she died.
Wow. Wow.
So, I mean, to say it doesn't happen, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, if you're going to use that Tuskegee flag, you better know what it means.
Well, it's funny because you parse out a very nuanced point. The legitimacy of distrust and the pretense of distrust to satisfy just a conveniently helped notion is a problem that many individuals face when they're trying to decide what to believe or what to think about certain issues. And I see that in the pandemic as well. There's kind of the legitimate belief of vaccine hesitancy, as you alluded to. And then there's simply the pretense of vaccine hesitancy, because for whatever reason, you have this notion you don't want to get the vaccine. How do you parse through that as a journalist? How do you dissect through that thought?
Well, if I take you way back to how I first started writing specifically on healthcare, it was after going through being a caregiver for my mother who passed away from ovarian cancer.
Sorry to hear.
She was diagnosed, and then a year to the day later, she died. And having gone through the medical system with her, after that was, you know, when you lose somebody sometime, and you see this with doctors who pick specialties, they pick specialties often based on a life experience. You know, and so with me, I started focusing on health and healthcare because I wanted to share information with the regular person, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, what they needed basically to stay alive. And so with COVID, that was the case. I felt like it was my mission every way possible to share what I could find out.
And when you would share this information, did you ever feel that there's a difference between people who legitimately wanted to learn and accept what was being told and those who were simply looking for opportunities to twist what was told to them in a way to justify what they already believed?
Oh yeah.
How does that manifest? Talk to that experience.
Well, I tend to buffer myself from things that upset me. I'm not on the debate team against people who have politicized stuff. I tend to buffer myself from that, but occasionally it happens. But I would see it, like, I watch CNN and other places, but CNN was doing an interesting story where this young woman would go into these rural areas, and when nobody getting vaccine and when nobody wearing masks, and she found these people who, you know, and everybody in that case had somebody or several somebodies or whole family of somebodies who died, not just got sick but died. And if you went back and asked the people, the relatives, well, what do you think now? And are you going to get vaccinated now? No, it was just God's will. And you know, when it's hard to argue when somebody says something about God.
Like, yeah, it's almost a conversation stopper at that point.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, well, okay. wish you well with that. But I recently saw something about a young woman who has created a foundation to talk about the people who died of COVID who were unvaccinated, because she lost several people who just refused to be vaccinated, herself included. But she says that they don't get a fair shake. People look down at them because they made the decision.
Right.
And I don't know what to think about that, but I'm not giving any money to her foundation.
That was a good one. I don't know what to think about. Let's transition and look forward. The experience of COVID for you as a writer and as somebody who experienced it, so as both a writer and a patient,
yeah,
how is this going to affect your writing going forward? And how is it going to affect how you believe readers will perceive your writing going forward?
Actually, that's an easier question to answer than you would think. This year, So, have you noticed that the conversations are shifting around COVID? Everybody wants to go back to normal. Whatever normal is. Whatever normal is, they want to go back to Andy and Mayberry. That's what they want.
Black and white.
Black and white. That's what they want. Everybody on both sides of the fence. And you know, and it's been a hard 2 years. And when you say 2 years, people think I've lost 2 years of my life. And people are ready to get back out. So from the journalistic, from the journalistic standpoint, I made the decision not to write about COVID anymore. I don't ever say never, but I'm not gonna write about it anymore. Because it's sort of covering COVID sort of broke me in a way. That this is a story that had real evidence, real bodies on the battlefield, and it literally didn't make a difference. And now here we are, people are ready to get going. If you look at booking flights now, everything is booked, double booked, tickets are high, so people are ready to get out. So you become Debbie Downer.
Yeah.
When you talk to people. So that's not why though. There is something more at play after COVID in terms of distrust of each other that makes me feel like, you know, I can spend my time writing about some happy stuff.
Yeah.
And so, but I will say this, I got a fellowship from the Rosalind Carter Foundation on Mental Health. So I am a mental health fellow in journalism, and I've never really written stories on mental health. But what COVID did for me is I saw something interesting and different. People were able to articulate their anxiety and their depression in ways that maybe they hadn't before. And so my premise for my fellowship is, how are people dealing with this? How are you gonna come out of this? And when I say this, I mean everything that happened in 2020, because you have these huge political, racial, and health divides in this country now. Or as Michelle Obama said, she was talking about her own state of mind, and she said she felt like she had a low grade temperature, but a low grade stage of depression. And when she said that, I'm like, yeah, that's what I got.
Yeah.
And so I am talking to people, writing about that, and the fact that this epidemic may reduce the amount of stigma we have in talking about mental health this moving forward, at least for a little while.
I hope that it's longer than a little while, but as you know, people are quick to revert to their base tendencies. So you will start to see a certain reversion, but I think many, many people have benefited by the strides gained in mental health awareness during the pandemic. Let's end on a philosophical note.
Oh.
As a writer, you tell the stories of people's lives. Now, going towards the latter aspects of the pandemic and transitioning into whatever phase is called endemic, whether that's a national term or regional term, whatever that transition is, we seem to be going through it right now, hopefully. What is the story now of people's lives for the rest of 2022? What is that story and what do you think it should be? Because there is what is and there is what should be.
I think long haul is going to be a huge story. I mean, you know, I'm seeing some things come across my desk about what COVID itself may have done to people's brains.
Yeah.
What inflammation is caused in people's bodies. I think that that's going to be a huge medical story moving forward. I think one of the other stories is how we get back to each other after all of this. You know, the story that takes up all of the bandwidth now is this war. And yeah. I think scaring a lot of people. So will that have an impact on us being kinder to each other? I really don't know. I think there'll be a lot of assessment, both personal and society-wise. What did COVID do to us? Really?
Yeah.
When you have those numbers of people who have passed away, you're going to see just like 911. Where were you when 911 hit? Where were you when Kennedy was killed? Where were you when COVID happened and what did it do to you? Yeah. I think those are going to be the stories. How many of them am I going to write? I don't know. I'm working on a piece. I'm going back to the Moth this year.
Oh, nice.
And my story is not on COVID, excuse me, on COVID per se, but some of my little nervous tics that I got living through COVID.
Wow.
So that will be interesting. But the other thing I will tell you is that in the media community, they're sending out messages loud and clear that we are moving past COVID. So when you pitch stories now, they want happy and light.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. Ms. Collier, thank you so much for your time. For the listening audience, can you let them know how they can get a hold of you or get a hold of some of your writings?
Well, I am on Twitter, but I'm not really active. I do not have a website because literally I've been too busy to get one. But you can find me on Facebook at Andrea King Collier at Facebook.
Perfect. And with that, Ms. Collier, thank you so much for your time and look forward to hearing you in your upcoming presentation on the Moth.
Thank you.